for us in First Corps, it is a recertification of us to either be a joint task force or a combined force land component commander for Pacific Command. We're the only corps that is assigned to a combatant commander, and that would be PACOM. So this is a very big exercise for us. In terms of the size of the exercise, it roughly involves 30,000 personnel total. And that's from all the different services. So we have the Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines playing in this, as well as a civilian component, which I'll talk about here in a minute. Roughly in our headquarters, counting all the enablers and counting our live forces that are out at Hamel, we have about 1,203 soldiers. So we have a headquarters that is here in Brisbane, and then we have a brigade headquarters that is out at Hamel from the 25th Infantry Division in Hawaii that is partnered with the 7th Australian Brigade, and they're doing some simultaneous training that's linked to the exercise. I am the commander of what's called a Combined Force Land Component Commander, which means I'm the land component commander for a joint task force. We have a mission right now. We're working in a notional country, and as part of our certification, we're training alongside other components from the Navy. They have the naval component, an air component, and then a special forces component, and then, of course, with the JTF headquarters. What is different this year is we've enhanced a couple of things. First of all, the interoperability of the exercise from a joint perspective in terms of having actual live headquarters at all levels. We've added what's called the Crisis Response Coordination Group, the CRCG. This is unique because we now have civilians from the agencies of the Australian government and ours that are embedded in our organization, that are actually embedded to help us with planning, with execution, and decision making. The second one, which is very interesting, is there's a UN Security Council resolution. This is an actual resolution, 1325, that discusses women, peace, and security. And this is the role that women play in terms of conflict and how they can help de-escalate conflict and what they can do to provide transition from conflict to peace. So we actually have a representative here from the State Department where we're playing that in the exercise. So this has changed the complexity of the exercise, and we've also added a second joint task force that is under the control of the Australian government. Add to that a hybrid threat, a near-peer competitor for decisive action combined with a campaign to transition to civil operations, and it's made this exercise extremely complex and challenging for all components. And that's some of the differences from 2 years ago.
So a lot there. And in terms of the overall exercise, when you put all those 30,000 people together, is there any particular mm-hmm. integrated warfighting scenario that you're simulating, or is it more a collection of different things with different objectives?
No, it's an actual scenario that was put together. So you have a scenario that was put together where you have two notional countries that have been destabilized by another organization, another country. Our job is to, in terms of defeating the military that has destabilized these two nations, return governance and stability and security to these two countries, and then reestablish legitimate governance, and then help us transition to the UN for legitimate elections within 6 months.
And that role of women in conflict, along with that UN Security Council resolution, mm-hmm. how's that actually playing itself out in the exercise? Are we mainly talking about female soldiers or female military members?
No, it's not about that. This is the beauty of it. It's not about female soldiers. Mm-hmm. It's really about what do you do with females in a culture that undervalues women. And the interesting thing about the Security Council resolution is that as of June 2015, 49 nations have signed the National Action Plan of this resolution. And it really talks about how to value women and how they partner in peace, how they partner in governance. How do you leverage the knowledge, experience, and the abilities of half a population as you transition from conflict to stability? How do women play a part in consequence management and conflict resolution? Where do they play in terms of governance? How do you value what they do in the society? And it's really an idea not to marginalize them, but it's not about our soldiers, our female soldiers. It's really about the population itself. And I think that's very unique, and that's a unique combat multiplier that we've taken into account in this particular exercise.
Yeah. On the interagency piece you mentioned, I saw you quoted in an Australian newspaper the other day expressing some admiration for the working relationship the Australians have between their military and civilian government, and suggesting we can learn some things. Elaborate on that a bit, if you would.
I think we can. I think it's the way they train together. I think the Australians have a unique way of training with their interagency. And I think as we look at what we want to do in the future, and I can only talk about the Army, in our Army operating concept of 2025, we talk about how to train in a joint intergovernmental, interagency, multinational environment. So in the future, how do we train with the interagency? How do we train up front in phase zero operations and shaping operations to bring the interagency in the beginning of the campaign plan, vice what happens in inserting them post-conflict? I think the uniqueness of what we've learned here in the Australians is they embed their interagency in the beginning of the campaign process. We had the privilege of bringing the interagency from Australia to Joint Base Lewis-McChord, where they participated in our academics, our train-up, and our command post exercise that got us ready for this. So when we came to this operation, we were already integrated with the interagency from Australia as part of the operation. It made it very easy because the relationships were built, the trust was established, and the uniqueness of what each agency brings in terms of how they integrate with the military planning process was understood. That's a unique thing, I think, that is very important here as you move forward in terms of interagency and how we do this. And I think we've learned some valuable lessons over the last 13 years that is going to have to allow us to look at how we want to do this in the future as we look at how our military evolves.
And how would you assess our interoperability with Australia? I mean, how's it different from working with a NATO ally? How's it different working with a non-NATO ally who's not officially part of that formalized structure of joint doctrine, equipping, et cetera?
Well, first, let me say that the Australians have been tremendous partners with us since World War I. They have been one of our most valuable, one of our most strongest partners we have in our alliance. And they're tremendous warfighters, tremendous professionals. They're a well-disciplined, well-motivated formation. And again, it's an honor and privilege to serve with them. We have really enhanced our interoperability, not only at the campaign, at the operational level, but also at the tactical level. So sharing a common operating picture, which is very important. We were able to integrate in the live fire piece of this, or not in the live fire, but in the exercise piece of this out in the training area. How do you pass tactical information and tactical data with different digital systems? How do we clear fires together? How do we process operations orders? That's just part of the tactical interoperability. At the operational level, it really has been seamless because we pretty much fight off the same doctrine. When you look at U.S. Army joint doctrine, that is what the Australians train towards. So when you look at phases of a campaign plan, when you look at transition from combat operations to stability operations, the Australians are already working off our joint doctrine. So from that perspective, it's really been seamless. What the piece that is different is how they approach it based on how they approach warfighting from their operational environment. I think what we've learned from them is they bring a unique perspective that we don't have. Over the last 13 years, our perspective has been Iraq and Afghanistan. They have been partnered with us in both of those. But in Australia, we've learned what they've done in the Solomon Islands, what they've done in Bougainville, and what they've done in Timor-Est and other places where they have done these transitions to civil operations, to stability operations, and they've taught us so much.
General, we've talked a fair bit so far about the questions you were asking as you went into this exercise. What can you say? Mm-hmm. What can you say about what you've learned and any key takeaways so far, or too early to say?
No, I don't think it's too early to say. I think it's very interesting is that when you progress from combat operations to stability operations, it is not a clear delineation moving from one to another. What I've learned is there are some gray areas in terms of how do you set conditions to transition from combat operations to stability operations? What are the key things that have to be done? How do you assess the security environment as you do that? What are the essential stability tasks that can be done simultaneously while you're conducting combat operations? And what I learned from this is that potentially you could be doing combat operations and stability operations within the same joint operational area. And that makes it very complex for the commander. The other thing I learned is the importance of having to coordinate with component commanders and share information. So whether it's the naval component, the Air Force component, the Special Forces component, this ability to understand the threat and have a common picture of the threat, and then the ability to share and pass information that leads to timely decision-making. That is one thing that I've learned again here, that the ability of a staff, the ability of components to bring information and assessments to the commander to facilitate his decision-making is something that's very critical in this kind of environment.
And switching gears just slightly in our last couple minutes, I know First Corps is getting ready to lose more than 1,200 people as part of the force structure decisions the Army announced last week. How, if at all, does that impact your ability to successfully pull off these kinds of exercises or readiness?
As I've said before, it's the 1,200 people that are going to depart JBLM, that won't impact our ability to train in the Pacific. What I'm concerned about in the future as we look through sequestration is the impact on our readiness. And that's what I'm really concerned about. We'll work through the training piece in the Pacific. We'll make the necessary adjustments. But the concern, though, is if we go to full sequestration, what is the impact on readiness? And the challenge also is what happens to modernization? Because there's three things we have to do in the Army. We have to have force structure, we have to have readiness, and we have to have modernization. If one of those are out of balance, one of those rheostats, it's hard for the Army to move forward. And my concern is that the modernization portion of this is going to be a bill payer for the readiness challenges that we'll have in the future.
And I know money for training and readiness in the Army's already been tight for the past couple of years. From a budget perspective, is it a stretch to pull off a large exercise like this? And how important is it to keep doing them when you're paying more attention to every single one of those readiness dollars?
I think the important piece is that these particular operations are important for the rebalance of the Pacific. Their importance to help General Brooks, my commander, set the theater, and their importance to enhance readiness. So it is something obviously we have to budget for, but on the other hand, we still have to have the resources to maintain our tactical readiness for global missions. I think one of the unique things about First Corps is we have to be globally responsive and regionally engaged. But these particular operations that we're on, to include Pacific Pathways, which is another operation that we've started in USERPAC, United States Army Pacific, is essential to sustain and build our readiness. And then we'll have to work our way through the budgeting issues as we move forward with sequestration.